Well, friends, I wonder if you've ever had any preconceived ideas, ideas which turned out in the light of day to be ill-conceived and wrong, or even a bit embarrassing. Well, in the early 1990s, some Aussie friends of ours were living in London, and one night they invited this English couple over for supper at 8 o'clock. So the English couple arrived, all dressed up, and with a bottle of wine under their arm. They'd come for supper. Well, our friends brought out some cheese and bickies, which promptly went, and they brought out some cake, and that went too, and so did the crackers and dip. So our friends had to search the pantry looking for something else supperish to serve. The English guests obviously had good appetites. Well, the reason for this was that they hadn't yet eaten their main evening meal. You see, to these English people, supper was the main meal. So they'd come expecting a substantial feed, not just some cookies and hot chocolate. And they were disappointed because they misunderstood exactly what the supper would be. Because from their own experience, they had a preconceived idea of what Aussie supper would look like. They were caught off guard and a bit hungry. Well, today we meet some people with preconceived religious ideas, ideas which are entrenched in their thinking. And Jesus, in his words and in his deeds, confronts these ideas head on. These ideas collide head on with Jesus. And in this passage, these people with their preconceived ideas learn a lesson that in Jesus, God had come into the world and life could not possibly remain the same. And friends, in Jesus, God has come into our world and our lives cannot possibly remain the same. So the first group of people with preconceived ideas are found in verse 1. They had these preconceived ideas of how religious people act. And at that time, of course, there were some very religious people, people who were very serious about their faith, the disciples of John the Baptist and the Pharisees and their disciples. And fasting was an expression of their faith. In fact, the Pharisees fasted far more often than the law required. They fasted every Monday and every Thursday. These Pharisees strove not only to keep God's written law to the letter, in their religious zeal, they developed many and extensive other rules to add to God's law. And the everyday people admired them for it. So everyday people had come to understand that the most serious people, the most devout believers, were those who regularly fasted, like the Pharisees. Their religious culture told them that to be truly devout meant engaging in regular, solemn fasting. So their preconceived religious ideas receive a jolt when they observe Jesus' disciples. A bit like the English couple had a jolt when my friends served them a light snack instead of a main meal. Because, as we saw last week, Jesus and his disciples had been feasting, not fasting, with tax collectors and sinners. So the people here in verse 18, therefore, want to know why Jesus' disciples don't fast, like the Pharisees do, like John's disciples do. Surely if they're religious, they surely must fast. Religious convention expects it and demands it. Well, in verse 19, Jesus has an answer for these perplexed people with their preconceived ideas. He doesn't disagree that fasting is good, but like a lot of things, he says, it's all a matter of timing. It's like when you're doing a cover drive in cricket, so I'm told, or when you deliver a punchline in a joke. It's all a matter of timing. And Jesus uses the analogy of a wedding feast to illustrate. A wedding feast is obviously a time when you don't fast. It's not a time for fasting, it's a time for feasting. And normally, wedding feasts in Jewish villages lasted for 7 days, and there was lots of food and wine and dancing and fun. And even the rabbis were expected to take a break from teaching the Torah, teaching the law, to join in the festivities. And here Jesus is saying that in his life and ministry, And in his very presence, there's a wedding feast going on. And his disciples are the wedding guests, the guests of the bridegroom. And the implication is, of course, that Jesus himself is the bridegroom. And because the bridegroom is still present, now's a time for feasting, not fasting. So the one thing the disciples must not do while Jesus is with them is fast. Now, they will eventually fast when Jesus is taken away from them. Look at verse 20. The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away. Then the people will fast. That tragic day when Jesus is taken away is a cause for fasting and mourning. Here Jesus is saying, one day, not yet, my disciples, my wedding guests, will mourn and fast because I'll no longer be with them. They'll fast in that day. And friends, this is a foreboding of what is to come, because of course Jesus eventually is taken away and betrayed and tortured and killed. But here Jesus uses the bridegroom of an analogy for himself as a big hint to his true identity. You see, friends, in the Old Testament, God described himself as Israel's husband, as the beloved of his people. We see that in Isaiah 54 and Isaiah 62 and Hosea 2. In fact, the bridegroom in the Old Testament, the bridegroom of God's people, is God himself. So for Jesus here to identify himself as the bridegroom is to identify himself as God. An absolutely extraordinary claim. But it's consistent with what we've already seen in Mark's gospel. So previously we've seen that Jesus has come doing powerful works that only God could do, and speaking powerful words, healing by these powerful words and teaching with authority, and forgiving sins as only God could do. So in referring to him as the bridegroom, Jesus is claiming to be God. In fact, friends, in Jesus, God has come into the world, and in light of this tumultuous event, life cannot possibly remain the same. Life cannot possibly be just business as usual, the same old, same old. Things must be different because Jesus has come. And that's basically what Jesus says in verses 21 and 22. And he uses two pictures to describe it. He speaks of unshrunk cloth and old garments, and of wine and wineskins. So, in verse 21, to take a piece of new unshrunk cloth and sew it onto an old garment is doomed to fail. The new piece of cloth will tear, probably the first time it's washed. And it will pull away from the old garment, and a worse tear will result. It can only end badly. And likewise, old wineskins are no good for new wine. New wine is wine that's still fermenting, still producing gas, and gas expands. So you only put new wine in new wineskins, which are soft and still have some give in them. You don't put new wine in old wineskins, which are rigid and hard and have no give. Otherwise, you just end up with a mess. So Jesus is the new patch of unshrunken cloth and the new wine. Jesus cannot be stitched on to the religious structures of the Pharisees. He cannot be contained by the old wineskin of their religious rules. No, Jesus came as the one who was to fulfill the law and the prophets. And the added extensive oral so-called law of the Pharisees were not to constrain him. Their laws about fasting were not to constrain him. He did not have to conform to the religious rules and preferences of the Pharisees, or the scribes, or the traditions of the elders. No, Jesus, the one who comes to fulfill the law and the prophets, is here. There's a paradigm shift. It's not the same old, same old. He's come as the new wine, and the wineskin of the Pharisees' man-made religious rules will not constrain him. Jesus, the new wine, will outline and exemplify the new wineskin of a truer, deeper understanding of the law. And this truer, deeper understanding of the law is apparent in two Sabbath controversies that Jesus is involved in. So the first is in verse 23 to 28. So Jesus and his disciples are walking through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and they're hungry, so they pluck some grain to eat. And the Pharisees confront Jesus. Why are your disciples doing what's not lawful on the Sabbath? And increasingly in Mark's gospel, we'll see that the Pharisees are looking to make trouble for Jesus. Now, the unlawful conduct that the Pharisees accuse them of is not so much that they're picking grain, because according to Deuteronomy 23, it was indeed lawful for someone passing through a grain field to pick the grain. They just weren't allowed to use a sickle. The problem for the Pharisees was that Jesus' disciples were doing it on the Sabbath. They were breaking the religious rules of the Pharisees regarding the Sabbath. Now, the Old Testament law in Exodus 31 and 35 prohibited labour on the Sabbath, including harvesting, Exodus 34. But in Jesus' day, the Pharisees and the other religious experts had expanded this and taken it to the nth degree. And they'd come up with a list of 39 classes of work or labour, which they said violated the Sabbath. And so they accused Jesus of disciples of violating the Sabbath because they picked a few bits of grain, as if they were involved in full-on harvesting. But friends, Jesus turns the theological table on these accusing Pharisees in verse 25. They who considered themselves religious experts. So Jesus demonstrates from the Old Testament a deeper, truer reality to the law. Jesus reminds the Pharisees of godly King David and his men when they were fleeing persecution from Saul and they were in need and hungry. David and his hungry men went into the house of God, that is, into the tabernacle, and ate the special bread of the presence, which only the priests were allowed to eat. And we can read about that in 1 Samuel 21. So in that instance, David didn't steal the bread. The priest gave it to him. That is, those who were needy and hungry were allowed by the priest, the interpreter of the law, to do what the letter of the law would not allow. The greater need in that case, the greater need to alleviate hunger and human need, trumped the lesser need, the need to obey the religious law. And Jesus says, if it's okay for David to disobey the detail of the ceremonial law in order to satisfy human hunger, then it's okay for me, Jesus, to disregard the rules of the Pharisees to do the same. Now, friends, for Israel, David was remembered as the great king, and the expected Messiah would be the son of David, the most famous descendant of David. And here in verse 25 to 26, Jesus is comparing himself favourably to David, as having at least the same prerogatives of David, as being a David-type figure, a Messiah figure. And in verse 27, Jesus explains to these religious experts a few home truths about Sabbath. He says the Sabbath was not made to rule over people, to be burdensome. It was made for their benefit, for their restoration, for their rest. But in practice, the extensive man-made rules of the Pharisees acted to make the Sabbath burdensome, as if the people were made for the Sabbath, as if, in fact, the Sabbath was, in some sense, Lord and Master of people. So Jesus emphatically says the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And even more emphatically, verse 28, he says, the Lord of the Sabbath is the Son of Man. The Sabbath itself is subject to a particular man, Jesus, the Son of Man. Jesus himself is ruler over the Sabbath. And here, friends, Jesus is doing two things. Firstly, he's claiming clearly authority over the Sabbath, the authority of God. But, friends, he's also using a special Old Testament title to refer to himself, the Son of Man. And this title comes from Daniel 7, and it refers to a special, glorious representative of God who receives power and authority from God to rule on behalf of God. Jesus uses this title as his preferred way of referring to himself throughout Mark's gospel. You see, in Jesus' day, everyone was looking forward to the coming of the powerful Messiah. And last week, we saw that in order to avoid blowing his cover, Jesus tried to keep his identity as Messiah somewhat secret, at least at this stage. But Son of Man, as a title, was less well known in Jesus' day. But it was a title that nonetheless speaks of an extraordinary, powerful ambassador of God. So when Jesus applies the title to himself, he refers to himself as the Son of Man. He applies this lesser-known title to himself to signify that God was powerfully at work in his life and ministry, he who is Lord of the Sabbath. Friends, in Jesus, God has indeed come into the world, and life, especially for these people at that time, could not possibly remain the same. Well, friends, in chapter 3, we again see Jesus in conflict with the Pharisees. And this time it's not in the grain field, it's in the synagogue. A man with a withered hand is a test case the Pharisees want. Would Jesus heal him on the Sabbath? That's what they want to know. Jesus has already defied their pet religious rules by allowing his disciples to pick some grain on the Sabbath, and he shockingly claimed to be Lord of the Sabbath. So what will he do when he sees this man with the withered hand? Now, friends, the Pharisees don't care a whit for the man with the withered hand. No, they just want another reason to accuse Jesus. And friends, Jesus could have chosen, I suppose, to avoid trouble, but he doesn't. You see, friends, the Pharisees have effectively been teaching false doctrine by their man-made rules. Rules which, according to Matthew 11, verse 4, with which they laid heavy burdens upon people and upon their consciences. And this false doctrine in the form of man-made rules needs to be confronted. So Jesus confronts it. Jesus has centre stage in the synagogue. So he invites the man with the withered hand into the spotlight in verse 3. Not over on the edge of the room, not in the car park after synagogue's finished. Jesus throws out a challenge in verse 4 and he asks the so-called experts in the law whether it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath or to do harm, to save life or to kill. So he asks these legal experts for a legal opinion. And that's not an unreasonable request to those who thought they were experts. Jesus could very reasonably expect an answer. But the Pharisees are silent. They're frustratingly silent. Don't they know the answer to Jesus' question? Haven't they understood Jesus' question? Do they consider themselves above answering Jesus, this lowly carpenter? Well, actually, they're silent because of something that's going on in their hearts. These Pharisees know that if they answer, they're going to condemn themselves. Their motives will be exposed. Their withered hearts will be exposed. They know that fundamentally to do good on the Sabbath is indeed lawful. To do good to people is lawful because the Sabbath was given by God for the good of people, for their rest and restoration. So if the Pharisees answer that to do good is lawful, then they'll have to drop their charges of law-breaking against Jesus and even acknowledge that he is Son of Man and Lord of the Sabbath and Bridegroom, that is, God himself. Acknowledge that in God, in Jesus, God had come into their world, and so for life, for them, life could not possibly remain the same. But for these Pharisees, such an admission is definitely a bridge too far. They dare not concede to Jesus that it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath. But if they answer that to do harm or to kill is lawful, then they're still exposing the evil intent of their hearts. In fact, when Jesus says in verse 4, do harm and kill, he's probably alluding to their intentions. Friends, even at this early stage, Jesus knows that these Pharisees have evil intentions. He knows that actually, yes, they would like to do harm to him. They would like to kill even him, so they keep silent. They're stubbornly set upon doing harm to Jesus, and in fact will soon plot to kill him. These Pharisees are silent. They don't speak out that which is true, that it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath. They do this in order to justify their hard-hearted attitude and plans regarding Jesus. And so, friends, this makes Jesus angry. We see that in verse 5. He's angry. He's furious with them. His anger stems from the Pharisees' hard-heartedness, their lack of compassion for the disabled man, their preference not to uphold the guts of the law, doing good, while giving a pretense of being scrupulous law keepers, their preparedness to see evil done to Jesus rather than to see good done to this man. So here Jesus, who sees men's heart, is angered by what he sees, their sin, their determined callousness, their false religion, and it makes him angry. Jesus, the one who knows the true meaning of the law, the essence of the law, the heart of the law, knows that to do good rather than evil is always right, and to save life rather than to kill is always right. Jesus, the true and perfect law keeper, Jesus is the true and perfect law keeper, so he does good in an ultimate and supernatural way. He says to the man, "Stretch out your hand." Jesus speaks his powerful word, and the hand is powerfully restored. Friends, the original intention of the Sabbath was for rest and restoration, to rest in God and to join God in his rest. So, friends, Jesus miraculously provides Sabbath restoration for this man on the Sabbath. Friends, not only is Jesus Lord of the Sabbath, he's the one who brings Sabbath rest to this man and to all who trust in him. So, friends, in verse 6 then, we see something appalling. Friends, these Pharisees have witnessed a miraculous healing in the synagogue. But they don't praise God. No, they promptly leave the synagogue. They rush out and immediately meet with the Herodians. And these two groups, the Pharisees and the Herodians, who are normally antagonistic to each other, immediately hold counsel together. Immediately they plot about how they might destroy Jesus, how they might kill him. Now that's extraordinary. What's driving these religious leaders to such extremes? Why destroy Jesus? Why want him dead? Well, friends, due to their hardness of heart, they fail to see that in Jesus God has entered the world. They fail to acknowledge Jesus' lordship. They don't want their lives and their ways changed. They don't want to yield their religious power. They're determined to hang on to power, influence, and prestige at any cost, even at the cost of destroying Jesus. So, friends, this morning we've seen that when Jesus entered the world, he brought huge change for the people of God, especially to the religious establishment, for those who were most sure of their religious performance. Since Jesus came as the new wine, the old wineskins of Pharisaic religion was obsolete. Jesus, the glorious Son of Man, came as Lord of the Sabbath, confirming God's Sabbath as restorative for God's people, rather than being as a Pharisaical burden. Jesus did ultimate good on the Sabbath rather than kowtow to the rules of the religious elite. Friends, because Jesus came into the world, it could no longer be business as usual for God's people. No longer the same old, same old. No longer would the preconceived religious ideas of the Pharisees rule the consciences of God's people. Since in Jesus God came into the world, life for the first disciples could not possibly stay the same. And in fact, for those who were truly Jesus' disciples, it did not stay the same. Now, friends, for most people in today's world, most people live as if it's made no difference that Jesus has come into the world. For them, it's business as usual, the same old, same old. Friends, most people go about their lives indifferent to the fact that Jesus has come, or even not even knowing that Jesus has come, even today, even in this country. Friends, since Jesus has come into the world, life for us cannot possibly be the same. For those of us who claim the name Christian, the fact that Jesus has come into our world must fundamentally and comprehensively affect how we live now and what we love now. It must affect how we use our time and our money and our resources, our opportunities, our talents, our education and training, our homes. As Christians, friends, and as a church, we cannot, we must not just settle for business as usual, not for the same old, same old. Friends, as individuals and as a church, we need God's ongoing grace and the work of His Spirit to change us, to make us more the people we're called to be, and to increasingly make us the church that God wants us to be, to make us increasingly committed to God's people and to God's mission, that more people may join His people, to reaching out to the lost with the gospel of Jesus in our neighbourhoods, in our families, in our workplaces, in this community, and in places further afield, perhaps for some of us in other parts of Australia or other parts of the world. Friends, because Jesus has come into this, His world, and because we've been called to Him, our lives are forever changed. May we, by God's grace, be people who live purposely and energetically for Jesus.